Park Place Meeting, Tuesday afternoon, 15th of June, 1976. Meditation essentially means being in communion, in the state of the supreme togetherness. This is the fundamental, the real, the all-inclusive meaning of the word samadhi. It has usually been translated as concentration. But to translate it as concentration is a little bit misleading. Concentration in this context means that the whole of you is completely self-collected and in complete harmony with the total self, which is the total universe. And in that sense, you are concentrated. You see, but only in that sense, not in the sense of paying exclusive attention to any one particular point or subject or whatever it may be. Because there you are still confined to the realm of the finite and the particular, and everything that is finite and particular is mortal. It comes into being, it makes its passage through time, and it dies. But samadhi is the timeless state. This communion, this supreme togetherness, is timelessness realized here and now through every single moment of time. This is the great mystery. You are aware in terms of timelessness, but the organism functions thus in terms of a movement through time. And the astonishing part of this process is that during this state of supreme samadhi, there is no decay taking place in the organism. That is the difference. But that lasts only for a certain while, because the organism cannot defy the laws of nature and continue perpetually through time and space as a finite organism. Anything finite has to disrupt sometime or other. So now, meditation means being in that state of communion, in the supreme sense. And it implies, most importantly, the emptying of the content of the mind. Why? Because the content of the mind simply is a collection of mental constructs. And all constructs, howsoever sublime or wonderful, are themselves finite and particular, and as such belong to the realm of mortality, and as such belong to the realm of that which is obstructive to the timeless, the infinite, the immortal. You get it? So, it's the dissolution of these, the quietening down of these. It becomes the whole mind, which in the ordinary way is like a muddied stream, becomes a perfectly pellucid stream. And it's a pellucid stream which is moving through time and space in terms of an integrated space-time consciousness in harmony with the stream of life eternal. This is what meditation really implies and means. And this is the climactic point of all religious disciplines, of all spiritual realization, of all complete and utter human fulfillment. the nirvana here now. The literal meaning of the word nirvana is extinction. That is its first meaning. But it means the extinction of all that obstructs the inextinguishable. And that is our particular, finite, limited, mortal thoughts, feelings, ideas, states of mind, desires, everything that has a particular manifestation. These things couldn't be said at all had not they been realized, become real, made real by living human beings, the great spiritual teachers. And that is our supreme and most precious heritage. And it is that which we can treasure. The spirit of it. Don't bother about the words too much. Here are a set of words which, if they inspire you, you can muse upon when you are by yourself. Now, in the ordinary way, the time sense is associated with space. Space in the sense of a limited locality. Not space in its infinitude. When this timeless condition is realized, is being experienced in immediate awareness as such, then you are functioning in the real integrated space-time. And it is an extraordinarily significant thing that in the modern world, this old teaching about the infinity of space and time, which was not very happily presented as separate stages, infinity of space, akasha, and then the infinity of consciousness, because consciousness is tied up with time and emerges out of bondage to time into timelessness. It was spoken of in separate terms. It is an integrated unity, this space-time consciousness. And it's a curious thing that in this century, at the beginning of this century, Einstein, presenting his special theory of relativity, brought out this space-time integration concept through sheer mathematical and scientific genius. He penetrated without being able to form pictures of it, concepts of it. He was able to penetrate through the right utilization of pure symbols, which means functioning in the realm of pure mind, into this inmost reality, and it has made all the difference from 1905 onwards to our conception of the fundamental nature of things. And this fundamental nature of things and the understanding of it has come so close now to the profound truths which were presented in Upanishadic, partly in Upanishadic terms and largely in terms of Mahayana Buddhism so many centuries ago. Mahayana Buddhism, 19 centuries ago, these great teachings were presented. We live in a wonderful world, so that our modes of meditation also necessarily must introduce the newness, the creative renewal, which should characterize our present age and our present stage. And this is where we make a little mistake if we just hark back to the age-old set-down lines. We start with them, of course. We must understand them, thoroughly know them, and then, if we thoroughly know them and they have become simple enough for us, we transcend them and are able to enter into the new. This is how mankind progresses in any and every sphere of his life. Isn't that so? It's the simple fact of how mankind progresses. Otherwise, there is no meaning to the word progress. No real worthwhile meaning. Now, what can we as a group do here and now immediately. We can try out certain little things. Most of you know what I have called the earth meditation. It is a simple way of unifying our idea of time and space, of unifying it and extending it, making it inclusive. Don't imagine for a moment that now when we practice this, we shall all sort of fly off into celestial realms of integrated space-time. Nothing of the sort. So let us just practice this and get the feel of this inclusiveness and see how it affects the whole psychophysical organism. So let us start. Let the body be comfortable, not slack, but free of strains and stresses, and breathe easily. Let your breathing be just quite easy. Now be aware of the fact that each one of us, I'll use the term I, that I am in this room. Be conscious of this body-mind organism. Let the rhythm of the breath affect the body in a happy way so that the whole body feels peaceful, feels alive, calmly alive, not restless, just calmly alive, but so happily alive that one says, oh, it is good to be alive. Now be aware of the fact that there are 42 people here present. We are all one group in mind and consciousness. I don't come to the end of my universe with my own skin, but in mind and consciousness I can hold all of you in a single awareness of a unitary whole. Now in this unitary whole, all antagonisms sink into nothing. They, in actual fact, are resolved into right relationship. We must not picture this right relationship. Just hold the idea of right relationship pervading all of us here. We are a unity, a great organism, instead of the little organism which is oneself. Nothing sentimental about it, nothing emotional, nor a cold, impotent thought, nor a disturbing, hot feeling, but a comfortable, warm feeling, conducive to life in terms of wholeness. Let the breath rhythm embody that for each one of you, and make it spread through the body and include everybody. And this is what we are doing at this moment here, at this time of the day, nearing 5 o'clock. And in imagination, let your imagination carry you right along the longitude in which we live, from the North Pole to the South Pole, in this part of the world, this half of the world. And the different people have been doing similar things and different things, having tea, talking, etc., at this moment, all along this longitude. And in imagination, you will need some time over this, in imagination, go eastwards, where time is further on. They will be having supper, perhaps. They will be going to theaters or discussing business or whatever it is. See this great arc of life from our longitude steadily sweep round the globe. The regions of midnight, of the small hours of the morning, of 5 o'clock on the opposite side of the globe in the morning. Gradually see that arc sweeping round and coming back to where we are, and hold it in your imagination and see all mankind at this single moment is thinking, feeling, speaking, doing all the things that characterize the life activity of men in every different place. There is war and horror, destruction, scheming, machinations. There is kindness and courtesy, and the work of healing and constructing and so on. Everything is taking place simultaneously now. In this single moment of the planet's life, everything that happens in the life of mankind during 24 hours is taking place now. And get the feel of that now in the here. The here being the planet, not just this room in Park Place. Get the feel of it. Let the mind see clearly how unhappily man pursues the wrong things. How few there are who have true vision, who have inner poise and skill of hand, cool judgment of the head, and the warm healing compassion of heart. And it is these things which can heal individuals and mankind. Just feel it all at once now. The whole earth, in a single instant, is equal to all mankind's 24 hours. So get the feel of living relationships. And it is these living relationships as they are which have to be cherished, fostered, loved, understood, and healed, made whole, holy. And if you can feel this and understand it with intensity, you will experience even here now a certain freedom in inner consciousness from the limitations imposed by space and time and by confinement to the drive of desire, the drive of pleasure, the cloying fear and anxiety which overcomes us, and so on. My life, your life, mankind's life are all one universal life in reality, however disparate they may appear to the superficial glance. And if oneself is in a state of calm now, come back quietly to where we are at Park Place. And maintain this state of mind which you have entered into, because this is our limited expression and experiencing of a state of wholeness, and to that extent it is a holiness, despite our knowledge of the deficiencies and the defilements that lie within us. See? Now try and preserve this state as we go out. But before we go out, there's one little point we might emphasize. If we can maintain this state of mind, we might associate our meditative walking with the idea of an exercise in freedom from greed, from lust, which is perhaps one of the fundamental ills of the mind. Lust for possessions, power, security, lust for God, for perfection, for nirvana, and all the rest of it. See? And to show, just as to illustrate how universal all this teaching is, I'm just going to read a few words from Clement of Alexandria's Stromata. The divine law trains men specially to self-restraint, laying this as the foundation of the virtues. If, then, we are to exercise control over the belly and what is below the belly, it is clear that we are to check lust by the law. Remember, this is ancient formulation, the beginning of the Christian era. And this will be completely affected if we unfeignedly condemn what is the fuel of lust. I mean pleasure. That's what Clement wrote. What a remarkable thing. He used the word fuel, the fuel of lust, word which you find frequently in the Buddhist texts, that this is the fuel for so and so. And just one other sentence. The Gnostic, the knowing one, is firm, not alone, so as not to be corrupted, but so as not to be tempted. For he never exposes his soul to submission or capture at the hands of pleasure or pain.
Recording of the meditative walking on Tuesday afternoon, June 15th, 1976, at Park Place.
Feel the softness of the earth, solidity there, hard, hurtful if it strikes you, comforting if you are in touch with Mother Earth like that. And the movement through space is a by your leave of all this. Man moves aggressively through space, self-assertively, never by your leave. It is not only we who are conscious and can make obeisance to the trees and the grass and the air and the sky and the clouds and everything, but they also commune with us without words, without thoughts. And they never say no to us deliberately, excepting insofar as their constitution makes it possible for man, makes it impossible for man to ride roughshod over them. So there is no conflict. It's an inner state of complete harmony with nature, with what is, the actual immediate changing reality. Remember, it is change. We too change. And they never say that I want to remain like this. This is nice, this is good, I like it, I want it to be always like this. They never say that. They have the wisdom of unknowing not to say nay to the laws of nature. We have that. Lack of wisdom. We have the lack of wisdom. We want to say no. We want it otherwise. And it is wishing things otherwise, which is one of the main roots of all the conflict and the misery we experience within ourselves and with other people, wishing it to be otherwise. So, by your wishes. Let all the senses operate fully. Just as they will operate quite spontaneously, don't direct them. But whatever comes to into us through our senses, just let it come and be in tune with it. This way, the senses become living chords of communion. You haven't got to think of communion, because you'll only think of your dictionary meanings of communion. Here you will be in communion. Be very much alive to the immensity of existence, so that the mind becomes free of the limitations of our particular little locality. See, confined in a small space. Look at our life in the big cities of the world. Millions of people huddled together, cheek by jowl, and desperately lonely, in spite of the millions around, pressing upon. Feel the immensity of this, and let that sense of immensity be the permanent background, so to say, of one's consciousness when one is experiencing the small, the limited. Notice in the midst of all this beauty of living nature, death, thin construction. But notice just objectively, this is how it is. Don't fight against it in the mind. It is part of what actually is. And if one can completely absorb peacefully what actually is, then the right inspiration to effect necessary changes for the better, the beautiful, the inspiration will certainly come, and very likely the means with which to effect it. The circumstance frequently changes by itself in a mysterious way, not because I have deliberately thought out something and changed it, but being quiet, I've allowed life in its immensity to work freely, and the change comes into being. This is an extremely difficult thing to learn. But when you have learnt it, when you are really on the way to learning it, you will find that it will actually happen. Isn't that so, Sydney? You see, this way you are affecting consciousness at its roots. Your mode of awareness, your actual mode of awareness. It is not another way of thinking, a different way of feeling, a method, a skill with which you release particular inspirations. But your actual mode of awareness, which is eternally part and parcel, integral part and parcel of the universal awareness, that undergoes the transformation. And it is, and this is the ultimate source of release for mankind, for each individual man, and for his full flowering. This is yoga of a transcendental nature. If you want to use that much spoilt word, phrase, transcendental meditation. Now, all these trees, the ground and everything, in their way, know that we are walking through. If you sit quietly for a while, maybe for a long while, and you really look and you really listen, you are in the state of listening, not in the state of searching for something which you want to find, but in the true state of listening, of looking, then all this will commune with you, and you will be aware that a communion is taking place. But if you get a flood of thoughts and ideas associated with it, or elated emotional upsurges, then it is not the real thing. It will be entirely quiet, beyond all conceptions and beyond all words. And when the whole experiencing is over, later on, next hour, next day, next year, 3-4 years later, you will find that certain luminous, profound ideas and concepts will take shape, which will be of use to somebody. In the great creative artist, this happens like a flash. So we'll have to, I think we better turn back and get into this, otherwise the time is getting out. Thank you. is a fairly easy way of putting yourself into at-one-ment with separate things. When we look at a flower, say that rose, and the sheer beauty of it, and we experience reactions rather than the supreme type of response to the rose which is possible for us. If we are perfectly quiet and in this meditative state, this state of communion, we shall actually experience the roseness of the rose, the dogginess of the dog, the cloudness of the cloud. And there will be no reaction against it, nor a grasping and an attachment for it, which means that the soul is in complete freedom. You know that extraordinary saying of Sri Krishna in the Gita, I am seated in all things and in all beings, and I myself am also not bound by it. This extraordinary freedom, this realization of the true aloneness is the supreme spiritual freedom which man can realize, which is the aloneness of transcendence itself. An aloneness which is totally non-dependent. Everything is contingent in relation to transcendence. But transcendence is the self-existence in the supreme sense, the Svayambhu, as it is called. And even in the highest flights of Buddhist philosophy too, you will find this, the self-existent mentioned here and there. You can't get away from it. The Absolute is the self-existent, not as a separate definable thing, but as absolute reality. And this is a way by which you can get some sort of touch with it. This is one of the meanings of saying you become the tree which you are looking at. And the tree and the cloud and the bird and everything is also in communion with us in its way. And in its way, each of these is permanently in communion with all the rest, whether it is fighting for its life and survival or not. This is the mystery. It knows no confusion. It knows exactly what's what. When the lion springs on the antelope knows exactly what's what. There's no illusions about it. It doesn't produce consolatory doctrines. Oh, this is... and so forth, you see. We do. You see how we get away from truth, supreme truth? We want to explain it. You can see how this sort of thing operates in relationship to the release of virtue
from inside us. Take the defilement which we call possessiveness, avarice, and so forth, possessiveness. If I look at the rose and experience the roseness of the rose, I simply don't want to possess it. I don't want to possess the rose. It has to be itself. I have to be myself totally and completely. And in that, there is that intensity of communion where the roseness of the rose is realized. I would destroy it if I tried to possess that rose. The possessiveness, avarice, greed, these things, these ill expressions of our psychical life energy are made whole expressions in the state of communion. And then there is no problem of taking and or giving. Everything happens by itself. When the taking process is necessary, it takes place. When the giving process is the natural, spontaneous outcome of the situation, it takes place. And this is the extraordinary beauty and the wonder of all that is, without exception. Then you will find you won't get thrown off balance by horrible news and wars and the awful murders that take place and so forth. They are awful murders. You take them into yourself with uttermost intensity, understanding and compassion. Absorb them completely into your psyche. And there a transformation takes place of such a nature that in your state of awareness, utterly pure and intense, transcendent energies flow in and out freely, working in their way, which we know nothing about, at least I know nothing about. That is the way of healing. It is the way of transmutation. And it is the real meaning of growth and coming to fulfillment of the entire cosmos. And when you've got the cosmos as your background, well, what is there to gain or to lose? You can't put the cosmos in your pocket. You know, in the religions of the world, they talk of making your peace with God, especially before death. How about making peace with nature, the bride of God, during our lifelong process of living? Isn't this a way of making our peace? Blessed are the peacemakers. Can peace be made in that mechanical sense deliberately? Peace is there if the living person is completely at peace. And the peaceful one
is never obtrusive anywhere at any time under any circumstances. If he never obtrudes, he is fulfilling the cosmic purpose of his existence. And in that sense, he is spreading peace wheresoever he is. We know from our own limited experiences, when a truly peaceful person enters the room where five or six of us have been arguing furiously or irritating each other, and the peace of God seems to descend upon us with His presence. So, we can be like that. We make our peace with nature. And in that peace, we have already established ourselves in the very heart of God. Because the feminine aspect, the woman, as mentioned in Genesis chapter 2, Esha, is the supreme inspiring source for every single man and woman on the globe in spiritual terms. It is Esha which makes us put forth our hand and attempt to pluck the fruit of the tree of life. But if, because we are unprepared for that fruit, which is transcendent awareness, we scar the tree of life and convert it into the tree of good and evil. But here in nature, we have a way of learning how to be free of that mistake.
We'll stop here now.
And we can all disperse as we please roundabout. And remember, at 6, those of you who want to go into the meeting room for the little meditation period. But be there punctually, please. Don't keep anybody waiting. That's it.